the fire filling our vision as we told her to go, the blood warm on my hands, Palor's eyes closing. Chris's eyes have filled.
I'm so sorry, Lee.
My voice comes out a croak. Did Ayla? Do you know if Ayla?
She made it safely to Norcia. That's how we got your note.
For a moment, my face is hot with Palor's feelings, his joy, his relief. Then they fade. Emptiness remains like the echoing silence of an empty room. A lingering shred of our last spillover, gone. I know, with the certainty of a slammed door, that it was the last. I'll never feel his love for Ayla, his love for anything, again. It's too intolerable to bear sitting still. I force myself up, a palm to the mattress, and Chris's ministering washcloth falls aside. My surroundings swim into focus. The room's single window, opened for the breeze, provides a view of the still-smoking husk of the big house. At the foot of the cot where I lie, the saddlebag containing the Hermeneuta and the annals waits for flight.
When do we go to Norcia?
As soon as you're ready.
I'm ready. After the pyre, we should go at once. The thought of training my friends without wings of my own makes me ill, but I push the horror away. I'll bear it. Compared with what's happening to Annie right now, it's the least I can bear. Palor bought us time, and I intend to make use of every second of it. Chris's tears spill over. The drops trickle down her cheeks, but she doesn't wipe them.
Lee, she asks, where is she?
When I start to say it, my throat closes. I remember Annie on her knees, the sound of a boot connecting with her face as power kicked her silent. Ixion's laughter. The whore quotes poetry. The way he held her by her hair as I was dragged away. And now she's beyond my help, in the hands of the ones who have hunted her and wanted her to hurt for as long as they've known her name. Even if she manages to bring down Ixion at the end, she'll suffer first. She's in the capital. Chrissa lifts her eyes, disbelieving. She's with Ixion.
Annie. After the procession into the capital, I scrub filth from my body in the apartments of Miranda Hayne, my legal counsel. It seems an age ago that I sat nervously in her office while she looked over my file and decided to take a gamble on me, despite an unpromising track record. I didn't believe I'd won her over until she left a handwritten note for my final match. Go show them what you're made of. We've both come a long way since then. I am no longer a guardian of the revolution, vying for first rider, and Hayne is no longer the minister of propaganda. Her crimes against the triarchy during the revolution were indirect enough, and her knowledge of the Inner Palace's current bureaucracy valuable enough to escape charges under the Restoration. But that has not left her without punishment. She has been set with the task of representing high-profile revolutionaries the Restoration saw fit to bring charges against, guardians, senior civil servants, and Atreus himself, who was tried from the grave. How many have you gotten off? I ask. I'm bathing in Miranda's tiny tub while she waits on the opposite side of the curtain, scrubbing Penelope's dress on a washboard. The sight of Miranda Hayne, engaged in such domestic activity, makes me more uncomfortable than the thought of her seeing me undressed, but I've been given no change of clothes. So far? The sound of scrubbing wool stops. None. Do you have a legal background? Mostly academic. The larger problem is that they haven't let the defense participate in selecting witnesses or jury. A knock sounds from the other end of the apartment, and Miranda inhales as if the noise made her jump. That will be the physician. She passes a robe through the break in the curtains. I'll dry your dress while he looks you over. The physician, it turns out, is Master Wellsey, whose tenure as palace physician spanned the entirety of my years as guardian. At the sight of him, grey hair gone fully white, my eyes prickle. Hello, Master Wellsey. There now, Annie, he says, dropping his eyes. He inspects me cursorily, while Miranda stands by the fire beating the dress dry. Her drawing room has the look of being recently stripped of its furnishings. The walls have faded squares where portraits used to hang, and the single seat I'm instructed to take is positioned as if it had been previously surrounded by a complete set of furniture. Wellsey diagnoses a concussion, surface-level abrasions, bruised ribs, and dehydration. Nothing that won't be healed with proper meals and time, but I'm not permitted any medication for pain relief. Wellsey phrases it like this, impersonally, as if there were not a very specific person behind such a needlessly cruel order. The name hovers unmentioned over the checkup until finally I say it. Where's Ixion? Wellsey's quiet, comforting patter stutters to a halt at the question. My voice sounds too small in my own ears. Miranda's eyes drift closed. When she looks at me, I see lines in her face I don't remember. He's making a tour of the island, an ascension tour. Your trial begins when he returns. His hope is to convict you before Freyda returns and to time your execution with the triple coronation. Traditionally, the ritual involves a sacrifice. I'm kept in a solitary cell for the week that follows, on the windowless side of the palace stockade, unlit save for the light that filters down the corridor from the guard room. At night, I dream of Ayla and wake straining for her, to feel nothing. She's hurt. She's far. You'll feel her again. I push away the fear that I won't, and go back to wondering whether Lee's dead. For 1 hour every day, I'm escorted to an audience with Hayne, who receives me in her stripped apartment, serves me tea, and seats me as close to the fire as my shivering body will allow while she helps me prepare my defense. It feels, if I can block out that I'm hungry, sore, and wearing a dead girl's dress that still smells faintly of urine, as if I'm a guardian preparing for some sort of official assignment with the Ministry of Propaganda. We work on elocution, on what to do with my hands and face. It reminds me of countless hours being humiliated in rhetoric class, of standing on the roof with Chrissa, practicing for a morale visit when I was first learning to believe in my ability to speak. We go over breath tricks to calm myself, where to look in the room, and when to break for water. When Hayne tells me to smile more, I'm incredulous. I'm standing trial. I don't think the jury expects me to answer questions smiling. You would be surprised. We practice smiling until my face hurts. We practice smiling as Hayne insults me, as she asks every prying, provocative, painful question she can think of. It's a script not unlike the one Power and I practiced when I mastered spillovers, but in reverse. Now my task isn't to feel the pain, it's to inure myself to it. Were you sharing Leo Stormscourge's bed at the time of your promotion to First Rider? This, like most of the case Hayne is preparing, is based on Megara Roper's original character assassination in the People's Paper during the Bunker Riots. In her article, Megara insinuated that I slept my way to the top of the rankings by sharing the bed of my former lord, Lee. That is none of their You stopped smiling, and it's all their business. Again. We run through the line of questioning again. No, I wasn't sharing his bed at the time of my promotion. No, I shared no bed. I honoured my guardian vows. When I point out that technically, the vows are not explicit about the deed itself, only marriage and progeny, Hayne purses her lips. We can't expect the jury to care about such nuance. Have you ever shared Leo's bed? The question catches me off guard. For a moment, I remember the feeling of his arms around me. The quiet, the night, the comfort of our held breaths. And then I see that fire. Miranda notices my silence. The answer, she says delicately, to that question, whatever the truth may be, is no. I remember how Lee looked when Palor sacrificed himself for Ayla. His wild, blazing smile. And am tempted to say, they want to call me his whore? Let them. I think they're going to form opinions about what we were doing on his estate, regardless of how I answer that question. She doesn't look up from her notes. Doesn't mean you need to help them. We were wed. In a deed in half-assed. Hayne looks up at that. For your safety, I would keep that between us. They will accuse you of breaking your vows, and that would be proof. I must blink for a second too long, because her voice softens. I'm sorry, Antigone. And then she makes me practice again, leaving out the mention of any deed in half-assed, smiling. Despite never having won a case, Hayne seems determined to prepare a defense as if we might. I don't dare tell her that I intend to be found guilty, but she picks up on what she takes to be a defeatist attitude nevertheless. You have to pivot. Didn't your rhetoric professor teach you anything? When I ask, did you fire on civilians, you don't just say yes. For a moment, I see the burning Lyceum courtyard and hear the screams. That protesters were stealing grain that the city needed, that I protected on a split-second decision and later regretted. Megara's insinuations about my love life were spurious, but the rest of her article was pretty accurate. I did fire on civilians. You followed laws that you later decided were unjust and helped dismantle. That's what you say. I've got my arms folded. These kinds of arguments, where Hayne defends my actions to me, are cropping up more and more as we delve into the heart of Megara's article. They feel like unnecessary punishment. The suspicion that Hayne's speaking sense only adds to my irritation. If they're going to sentence me either way, I don't see how it matters what I say. I should just plead guilty and get on with it. The sooner I'm found guilty, the sooner we get into the arena. I have half a mind to come clean to her right there. But Hayne's frustration outstrips mine fastest. She slams the people's paper clipping on the small crate we've been using as a table. First of all, that's not an option with show trials. Second, even if it were, you should do no such thing. Why not? I am guilty. You are guilty of being trained to use a dragon and groomed by an ideologue to be his enforcer from the age of 6. You are guilty of trying to do your job as well as you knew how. And when you saw that your job conflicted with your vows to uphold justice, you learned. Do you think Ixion and his ilk are in danger of similar improvement? I'm not saying Ixion's better. Then straighten your back. Burning with a strange fury, I square my shoulders. Hands on her feet, glaring at me, her eyes glistening. They may rig it against you. They may try to write you into history as a villain, but I will drink hemlock before I let you accept that without a fight. Do you really want Ixion to have the last word of your story? There's more than one way to win. That's where she's wrong, I tell myself. There's only one way to win, and it's in the arena after I've been found guilty of everything they charge me with. I don't care who has the last word. Words don't matter. What matters is the dragon fire at the end. You know what, Antigone, says Hayne. Do it for my sake.
32. Traditional practices. Lee, the Highlands. Nigel's the one who remembers the rites of widowing that accompany the pyre and finds me once I'm on my feet again with the appropriate equipment. The sackcloth's a bit impractical this time of year, but you might still want to do this. He holds out a pair of sheep shears. My stomach tightens as I understand. Chrissa sits down with me on the back step of his cottage to do it. I lean over my knees and her deft hands circumnavigate the still tender burns on my scalp, snipping away clumps of black hair that drift across the garden. The metallic singing of the shears cuts through the quiet evening. Who do you want to ride with, Tenorcia? She asks. It's the first time I've considered how I'll be getting there. As a passenger. Chris's touch is light on my wrist, bringing me back. The ground feels heavy under my feet. I realize I haven't answered her. Cor's the obvious choice because of Morana's size, but not if I'm like this. Chrissa's the one I've always found it easiest to show grief in front of. Even if our romantic history feels like ancient history, the ease born of it remains. Can I ride with you? Of course. After she's done, we walk together up the hillside to the pyre Cor and Nigel have built among the barrows. For a moment, the sight of Palor arranged as if he were sleeping, a silhouette against the sunset, makes the reality of it warp. I must have dreamt it. He's right there. He'll turn to look at me and I'll feel him again. But he doesn't, and I don't. Chris's grip on my arm is tight. When Cor turns to me, his face is contorted and blotchy. There's no sign of the chain-link net the Grey Riders threw over Palor's silver wings, and his great head is turned so that I can't see the cut across his jugular. But it must have been Cor who found this evidence and obscured it. He knows how Palor died. What he wouldn't have known from that evidence is how proud we were. Of our bondmate safe, of our great fire protecting her, of our beautiful eggs, of the boy we left behind to stand on his own feet. The memories of Palor's emotions refract and separate as I find myself in them. I press a palm in the same spot on his scaled face where I held him. The scales that have always been so warm to the touch are now cold. You saved her, but I wasn't able to save you. And now he's gone, and I'm left grounded on this hard earth, alone. The rites of the fallen dragon are conducted without words, though the motions are identical to those of the fallen dragon lord. Cor Siomarana lights the pyre and I add the sacrifice, a fat salmon for Palor's first feast in the afterlife. We forego the traditional slicing of the dragon keeper's hand, though Nigel offers to perform it. The pyre burns down as night falls, and the wind drags cool fingers over my scalp. Chrissa sniffles quietly beside me. Cor clenches my shoulder with characteristic awkwardness, but I don't shift away. Nigel doesn't need to tell me what happens when the last embers have gone out. I cup Palor's still warm ashes in a smarting hand and smear them across my cheeks and along my exposed nape. All that's left beside the ashes is the bones. The barrow mound that will house them remains to be built. It's dark, the sky glowing with smoky starlight, when I climb on Phaedra's back behind Chrissa.
As we lift with Cor Siomarana from the ground, I bury my face in the back of her flame suit so I don't have to see the ground shrink beneath an unfamiliar wing. Chris's hair, like my face, smells of funeral ash. Her arms are folded tightly over mine. She doesn't try to make conversation. But I lift my head a few hours later when the sun begins to rise. Nausea spreads before us, surrounded by the cast of Sailor's Folly. It's the first time I've ever seen it up close, and with dawn weaving gold threads through tendrils of mist, lighting the barren crags, it's so beautiful it takes my breath. For the first time since I woke without Palor, it occurs to me that there are still sights in this world that can do that. Maybe right now I can't remember what there is to live for, but I don't have to. I just have to do what I promised Annie I'd do. The only way past grief is through it, but on the other side, someone needs me. I can't afford to keep her waiting. We land on the highest ramparts of the citadel, where I dismount and shake Griff Garrison's hand. He takes one look at my shorn head and ash-marked face, and doesn't have to ask where my dragon is. Leo. Those bastards. He learned my dragonborn name from my family and his former lords. Dressed in a well-cut tunic I suspect was pilfered from a Haerelian armoire, Griff looks little like the scruffy squire who once tended me in secret after a Pythian airstrike. This time, I'm careful to use the same respectful register with him that he does with me. These days, I go by Lee. When he asks how I've been holding up, I tell him I've been better. But also, here on these ramparts with the sun bathing this new world in gold, with Annie across the sea on a fighting chance, and the wartime lore of Sturmscourge House slung over my shoulder, I remind myself I could be worse.
Heard you might be able to help us with that Goliathan, Griff says.
Annie, Callipolis. By the evening before the trial, I can go through every prepped question smiling, hands still, shoulders straight. We've burned every candle down to the nub by the time Hain pronounces us done, but I can tell she's satisfied, even surprised by my progress. For all your poor marks in oration, she says, you train well. Shame I'll lose either way. Her lips tighten. Do you want to lose? She asks. Yes, because our plan depends on it. I lift a shoulder. Who will be leading the Inquisition? I'll find out when you do. The usual guard has arrived to escort me back to my cell. Hain tells me she'll see me in the morning, to join my escort to the trial. After rounding the corner that leads away from her apartment, we take an unfamiliar turn. The guard leads me away from the stockade and into the Storm Scourge wing. I only understand when we stop outside a door whose filigree of Highland heather glimmers in the light of the nearest sconce. At the guard's knock, Ixion opens it. Hello, Antigone. He's in a loose tunic and trousers, backlit by a crackling hearth. He smells of dragonfire. As I stare up at his face and contemplate the chamber beyond, I know this is a moment we have both, on some level, been expecting. I knew when I agreed to Power's plan that this was a part of what I would face. After kicking girls out of schools and barring them from the dragon-riding fleet, why should this return to tradition come as any surprise? I own you, Ixion said once, and he's been waiting ever since to prove it. The guard releases my arm and walks away without looking back. I place one numb foot over the threshold, then the other. The door closes behind me. I can feel the blood in my fingertips. But beneath that pulsing blood, I feel impatience. After watching Palor bleed out, after watching Farhall burn with Lee inside it, Ixion thinks this is how he'll break me? I've endured so much worse in this life than this humiliation. I endured worse at the age of 6. Sit, he says in dragon tongue, gesturing to his bed. When I do, his lip curves. They say that when you get them cornered, the struggling stops. Ixion is Lee's size, head and shoulders taller than me, built like a dragon lord. Neither of us is under any illusions that this is a fight I can win. Animals? I hear myself answer in Kalish. Or women? Ixion's smile widens. For a moment, we are so still, I think we're both waiting for the traditional performance to begin. But he turns away. He walks to the fire, roaring in the grate, and inspects what appears to be a poker buried in the embers. Cattle, he says. For half a breath, I don't understand. Then he pulls the poker from the coals, and I see the Storm Scourge cattle brand. The S encircled by heather, that marked the meager herd my father tended for his lord. I feel myself grow lightheaded. I'm curious, Ixion says, if you'll beg this time, or merely recite more poetry. I wake on the floor of my cell, my skirts stuck to the seared flesh of my thigh, and when I shift, I have to bite my tongue against the scream that rises. I'd steeled myself for violation and for shame, but I had not steeled myself for this, for simple, obliterating pain. His cool dismissal afterward, and my numb walk back to the cell are a haze. The brand killed all feeling in my leg when it was applied. The pain mounted slowly, and then I lost myself to it. A guard is at the cell door, which has creaked open. I only realize he's there, and that he's spoken, when he repeats himself. Get up. It's the same guard who left me with Ixion last night. The light has risen. It's time to go to trial. But when I roll onto my knees, plant my palms on the ground, and try to push to my feet, the fire that redoubles in my leg makes me see white. I bite my lips so hard I taste blood. For a moment, I think I won't be able to get up from my knees. A voice that belongs to another life echoes from a great distance. They watch us kneel. But they don't realize you can think from your knees just as well as from your feet. The memory of my father restores the breath to my lungs, and I feel a fire beneath my lids so hot it brings tears to my eyes. I feel that I am catching fire myself, and not the way Ixion wanted when he branded me. Sing me now your fury song. I push to my feet. Fury powers me through the pain. I favor the injured leg, keeping pace with the stone-faced guard as he leads me through the inner palace to the courtyard outside the Hall of Plenty. When I step outside, I force the limp from my stride and cross the lawn to the carriage waiting for me. Green shoots are poking through the dead winter grass, and the sky has broken with spring cumulus that, were I still a guardian in training, I would spend the morning flying in. Good morning, Antigone, Haynes says, opening the carriage door. Minister. Haynes' expression changes as I take the seat beside her. What happened? It didn't occur to me that even if I masked the limp, my appearance must betray me. The tear stains, my hair, I sweated like a pig after the branding, and I'm sure it's slick with oil. I have just enough presence of mind to know that this rage is fragile. I can't afford to tell Miranda what happened, because pity would make it crumble. Until last night, I didn't care what happened between now and the moment I'm found guilty. But Ixion changed that. The fight can't wait to begin at the arena. It begins now. I need them to find me guilty. They will find me guilty. But between now and when they do, I will fight to defend my name because I am not the guilty one. The sticky, mottled S on my leg will not speak for me. I grind out the only answer I can manage. I'm not giving Ixion the last word. We're moving. The courtyards out the carriage window give way to palace gardens. Hayne's gaze, a little too bright, flicks briefly down along my body as if searching for evidence. I dread the question, but Hayne doesn't ask it. Her voice is soft, masking emotion, but barely surprised. Do as we rehearsed, and he won't have it. She pulls a kerchief and a canteen from her purse and holds them up, a silent offer. I nod. I'm beginning to feel dizzy again. My stomach lurches with the carriage. She wets the kerchief and wipes my cheeks, my forehead, my chin, and my neck. Then she produces a comb, which she picks through my snarled and oily hair. Turn your head the other way now. I let her braid my hair. The faded impression of my mother's hands swims through my woozy head. When Hayne offers me a slice of bread and cheese, I nibble on them. When she passes me the canteen, I empty it in one long swallow and wipe my mouth. I had not realized, until water touched my lips, how thirsty I was. The carriage comes a little better into focus. There she is, Hayne murmurs. Is there any more water? Hayne is silent for a moment. I'll make sure to get you more, but you also shouldn't take the stand on a full bladder. The crowds begin to gather after we've crossed Highmarket Bridge. Shop fronts that were bombarded during airstrikes, ravaged by riots, and finally rebuilt under Freda are boarded up again on new shortages. Noses press against the carriage windows, palms smack the glass, drawn faces, bared teeth, dirty bony hands. We can hear everything they shout at me. My city, I think, with a sorrow unrelated to myself, larger than myself, as the pounding glass reverberates in my aching head. My city, always frightened, always hungry. And it's endured enough. They wanted it to be an open-top carriage, Hayne says. I talked that down. On grounds of your safety. But curtains weren't negotiable. It's fine. I want to see it. The crowd chokes our route through the people's square and mounts on stoops along the triumphal way. We cut through Scholars Row, passing the gates of the Lyceum where I studied as a guardian, and then we enter the manufacturing district, still gutted from the midwinter attack. The vault, the city's most ominous administrative building, looms over us as we approach. This was where I interrogated Megara Roper months ago, and where, during the bunker riots, the Passy protesters based their occupation. They demanded reforms on the streets and in the papers while I quelled the mob. There's a courtroom in the vault. Hayne nods. They've been using it for the Clover Tribunal. It's open to the public that can fit, but it's secure against rescues. The carriage halts in front of gates dwarfed by the windowless fortress they contain. The gathered crowd presses closer. When a guard opens the door on my side, I think the ground 2 feet below might as well be a leap from Dragonback. My skirts have stuck to my thigh again, and the fury that fueled me ebbs as dizziness swells. Does the peasant need a hand? I do a double take of the guard and find the sneering face of power. He is dressed in uniform as a grey rider for Skyfish House, but he wears no battle armor. When I reach out to clutch his arm, he braces it. I hear the words they're shouting now, but it's nothing new, the things they're saying. Power's arm remains under my elbow as we make our way inside. His lockstep alleviates my desire to limp. To my relief, the main courtroom is on the ground floor. Power fits my wrists into the shackles waiting for me at the stand. Then he turns, salutes smartly to the judge, and I look up. Ixion smiles at me from the lead chair of the Inquisition. Good morning, Antigone.
33. The Clover Tribunal. Lee, Norcia. At my first dinner in the Great Lord's Hall, I take a seat among the Kallipolan refugees and see faces I haven't laid eyes on since the coup. Many of them embrace me, weeping. Mrs. Sutter, Kor's mother, kisses my forehead, and Mr. Sutter shakes my hand. After it's gone on long enough, Krissa and Kor insert themselves at the bench on either side of me and attempt to buffer the harder questions. But Duck slips past their defences. How are you handling the sorrow spells? That's when I remember he was widowed too. He slipped into the seat across from me and leans forward to speak in confidence. Kor is too startled to intervene. I think he must be as surprised as I am by Duck's newfound self-assurance. If you need to talk, me and Mabelena can help. It's manageable, Lee. He sounds earnest, even hopeful, as if he wants to make clear life goes on. It's plain to see that for Duck, it has. He's made a home for his family and the other refugees in a vacant Haerelian manor. He tells me how the ballroom has been converted to a school where he teaches letters to Norcians and a girl named Lena, whose relation he doesn't explain, but I gather from Kor's rolled eyes, teaches Norish to Kallipolans. The sheepish boy we used to protect from bullies has been replaced by someone who has found his footing in the world. I suppose I shouldn't be so surprised he's found it on the ground. I'm installed in a suite with Kor. Krissa sleeps next door. There are empty rooms in the refugees' manor I could have had to myself, but I don't question Kor and Krissa's decision to keep me from being alone. In solitary moments, time seems to stop. The walls tilt sideways and I find myself staring up at the ceiling with visions of dragon's blood pooling and Annie's tear-stained face. I can't shake the feeling that I'm faking being here, being alive. That at least until I see Annie again, on the other side and in one piece, living is a performance. With Palor gone, will it always be a performance? It's been a performance before. There were days and weeks and years in my childhood where I felt I was pretending to go on. I got good at it. These muscles at least have the privilege of moving from memory. The thing that kept me moving then and now is work. Well, what do you know? Kor says when I show them the formations favored by my great-great-great-grandfathers. Lee's family has its uses. For a change, I mutter, and Kor lets out his characteristic barking laugh. I realize I've missed it. The thing is, I'm not sure any of them work. Well, no way to know until we try them. We outline the drills the way we've always done, as if it were a squadron leader meeting back in the Guardian Corps, not a last-ditch exercise in exile,
where one of us will play drill master from the ground. Griff tells the Woad Riders to take their orders from me and that he'll train with us when he has time. He himself is busy preparing for a coronation that will take place in the old Norsian style to crown him High King. Morning dawns with the conditions I need. Enough fog to prevent clover observation from the mainland, but not so much that we can't train. On the Citadel balustrade, at the appointed hour, I find an array of guardians and Woad Riders waiting in their flame suits, armed with javelins, their dragons saddled. I'm more surprised when a flash of amber slithers across the flagstones and coils herself beside me. Ayla has joined us. Her golden eyes are fixed on me like she's listening too. I lower my hand, not quite daring to reach for her like I would have reached for Palor, but her muzzle brushes my palm, closing the rest of the distance. I feel that her touch connects me to Annie, connects me even to Palor. And for the briefest instant, an image hovers in my head of eggs. Her eyes, his eggs, our eggs. And I know I've shared minds with Annie's dragon. It shouldn't even be possible. But the mystery of the moment doesn't change its power. For a flashing instant, Ayla filled the emptiness left by Palor's absence. The familiarity of that feeling, of the old connection, penetrates the loneliness and the numbness for the first time in days. Ayla, at least, understands. I maintain contact with Ayla as I speak to the core. Let's get started. It's easier to miss the saddle alongside a dragon missing her rider. Ayla remains with me on the balustrade when they leave us behind and we watch the drills together. With a cast as a size comparison, I'm able to confirm what I was worried about even in Farhall. Obizuth won't be subdued by the kind of attacks I found in my family's books, at least not the way I've made sense of them. The riders pepper the cast with javelins that might as well be mosquito bites in the hide of a Goliathan. And at the end of the day, I tell them good work as they slide sweaty from their dragons' backs. But privately, I'm stumped. What am I missing? By the time they land, I'm so consumed by the puzzle, I've forgotten to miss flying. I've forgotten I'm even faking. I'm also pretty sure Ayla's snorting with my frustration. When Kor dismounts at my side, his glance goes to the dragon, but whatever he guesses is happening between us, he doesn't comment on. These formations aren't going to work, are they? Don't tell the others. I'm going to figure it out. I've got to. Annie doesn't have forever.
Annie, Kallipolis. As the trial begins, I'm aware, dimly, of all the ways I'm messing up. I'm not smiling. I stumble through my answers. I fail to pivot. Several times, I have to ask the examiner to repeat his question. When Ixion is the one questioning me, smiling all the while, I dig my fingers into my knees beneath the table to prevent them shaking. He's not the only one who questions me. But the fact that my examiners rotate, taking breaks, allows them to deny me a break of my own. The vault's walls are too thick to hear the city bells. The only clock sits behind me, and I'm shackled facing forward. I have no way of knowing how long I'm forced to speak. The questioning continues until I slump onto the desk and have to be revived. We adjourn until the next morning and emerge from the vault after dark. On the carriage ride back to my cell, free at last to contemplate the ebbing waves of agony in my leg, I decide there is something deliciously ironic about failing so spectacularly and irreversibly in such a setting. Public speaking has always been my bane. I would have failed at this task no matter how much I prepared. The branding only helps accelerate the inevitable. I went into the vault telling myself I would not let Ixion speak for me, and then sat through 12 hours of him doing exactly that. I'm too tired to even care. Miranda Hayne, seated beside me in the carriage, seems as exhausted as I am. "Until tomorrow," she says, when the carriage stops before the Hall of Plenty. Though I sluice the burn with the cold water provided for my supper, there's only so much such treatment can do, and the pain keeps me awake through the night. What fitful dreams I have are of Firhall burning, of Palor filling the sky with fire, of three beautiful eggs. But when I wake, I still can't feel Ayla at all. On the second day, my performance does not improve. I have trouble, especially under Ixion's smiling interrogation, following the thread of his questioning. I have trouble focusing my vision at all. I'm enjoying 5 minutes with my head in my hands during the toilet break Miranda eventually demanded, when it's interrupted by someone kicking open the stall door despite her protests. I jerk upright at the sight of the Grey Rider uniform and then realize it's Power. "Do you mind?" "Let me see your leg." His eyes are bugging. Miranda, who has been leaning against the sink with the heel of her hand pressed to her forehead, straightens slowly. "Power? What?" But I am feeling something impossibly tight begin to unknot inside me. "Who told you?"
"I got drinks with Ixion last night."
"Oh, so you're drinking buddies?
Let me see your leg."
I reach down, seize the hem of my dress, and yank it up. It's the first time I've seen the wound in full daylight. My own stomach turns at the sight of the seared and mottled flesh, the livid trace of an S against my skin. Power's clenched fists tighten. Miranda, peeking around his shoulder, lets out an expletive.
"What is that?" "It's a Storm Scourge cattle brand," says Power through gritted teeth as he bends to inspect it.
"My dad used to put them on our sheep," I add helpfully. Hayne's hand is over her mouth.
"She needs to see a physician."
"No," Power says.
"No what?"
"No, I already suggested that to Ixion, and he said it was not necessary." Power's jaw is working. He reaches into a pocket and retrieves gauze, which he hands me to wrap the wound, and a bottle of numbing tincture, which he shoves into Miranda's hand.
"No more than 3 drops every 6 hours. If anyone asks, I came in here to gloat."
It gets a little better after that. The room stays in focus. I can answer most of the questions with complete sentences. I'm even, with questioners who aren't Ixion, able to force a few smiles. But the more lucid I become, the more apparent the hostility of this courtroom is. The audience is full of members of the Passy, the Order of the Black Clover, and the same class bronzes and irons who shouted insults at me during the bunker riots. When my interrogation finally pauses for witnesses to take the stand, my relief at the break is short-lived. They question Wes Gorin, the drill master who loathed me, Lucian Orthos, the general's chief of staff who so resented my rank, Jester, the street lord on whom I fired when I defended the Lyceum granary from a Passy raid. Megara Roper sits among the journalists admitted, her pen poised on a notebook to record the proceedings for the People's Paper, her lip twisted with dispassion. Our brief alliance during my rescue mission does not seem to incline her to be more forgiving toward my earlier track record. The righteous rage I felt after leaving Ixion's chambers sputters at the sheer and obvious futility of it. What point is there defending myself to such an audience? Whatever defense I make will be twisted beyond recognition anyway. The week goes on, and I slip deeper and deeper into a fugue of disaffection. I see it mirrored in Hane's face. On the final day, Ixion questions me on a subject that is clearly of great amusement to him.
Have you ever shared a dragon lord's bed?
He is smiling. I know the bed that he's thinking of is the one in which he threatened me, branded me, and made me beg for coolant. I stare into his grey eyes, and the answer Miranda Hane trained me to give fades. To hell with them. I'm damned anyway. The Guardian program is dead. To hell with these vows, this farce, this boy making a mockery of the sweetest moment of my life. I did. There are ripples of surprise through the audience. Ixion blinks once. And for that matter, to hell with the names they call me. I shared the bed of the one to whom I was wed, in Farhall. Miranda Hane in the front row lowers her face into her hands. Power arches a brow. Ixion's smile falters, then widens with incredulity.
You were wed?
Check the deed in Harfast. I can see Ixion is startled, even to my surprise, unnerved. Instead of belaboring that I've just confessed to breaking my vows as a guardian, he twitches a hand toward the scribe.
There will be no need for that. Scratch it from the record.
He asks no more questions about my intimate life, but the whispering continues. In the carriage that night, Hane is stiff with disapproval. You shouldn't be so disappointed, I tell her. The sooner they sentence me, the better. Add vow-breaking to the list.
It's not so simple as that, Hane says.
Oh? It turns out the Restoration has been discouraging what they're calling cross-birth marriages, which saw a rise under Atreus and are in talks now of being outlawed. My revelation was more than distasteful, Miranda explains. In the current political climate, it's incendiary. One more way I'm a peasant forgetting my place.
Good. The sentence should be forthcoming over the weekend, she says. They intend to make a spectacle of the verdict in the throne room. But tonight there will be a feast, and Ixion asked that you serve. I think of pointing out that the city's starving, but then that's never stopped the Triarchy. I'm under arrest.
I think, Hane sniffs, the point is more the circus of it. Your claim today made him particularly vindictive. In the courtyard in front of the Hall of Plenty, light spills from the hall and glints on the thawing pond. The statue of Pytho the Unifier has been restored to his dragon and painted in garish gold. Before I step from the carriage, Miranda passes me Power's numbing tincture for an evening dose. Outside the hall, also dressed to serve, I find Rock. With something less than a smile, he pulls up the sleeve of his serving jacket and shows me a forearm marred by a mottled, scabbing S.
I hear we match.
And then I'm in his arms, and he's crunching me into the first embrace I've had since I watched the big house burn. And I don't want him to let me go. 34. Freda Basileon. Annie. Rock was recaptured, he explains, the night the Guardians escaped. and the rider who took him out was Power. At my exclamation of surprise, Rock shrugs.
I thought he was going to kill me, to be honest. Instead, he brought me back here for a bit more hail. But we always knew he was a twisted little ass, didn't we?
I don't think Rock wants to hear my theories about it being a bit more complicated than that. Like me, Rock's awaiting a death sentence, but Ixion doesn't seem eager to rush it, and in the meantime finds Rock's presence diverting enough to keep around.
They'll mostly leave you alone if you're quiet enough, he tells me in a lowered voice as we make our way up the servants' entrance to the back of the Hall of Plenty.
He indicates his brand.
Which arm did he do it on?
He didn't do it on my arm. Rock's fists clench.
He did my brand after he burned down Thornham.
Of course he did. Not for the first time, I appreciate the small ways Rock and I share roots. I ask with dread, your family?
Safe, in Norcia, thanks to you.
It's the first thing I've had to be relieved about in days. Not until we set foot in the Hall of Plenty do I realize that when I was told I'd serve at the High Table, it would be the same table where I once was seated at my first feast in this hall for the Lycian Ball. I sat beside Lee that night, dazzled by the finery. It was the first time I'd ever worn a formal gown. Tonight, Dragonborn swarm the table that was once ours. Only Freyda is absent. Titus Greyheather, the eldest of the Stormscourge bastards, occupies my former seat. At the head is Ixion, and to his right sits Dilo. I stiffen at the sight of them, and Rock nudges me to keep moving.
It's better if you don't make eye contact.
I know from the minute tilt of Ixion's head when I first refill his glass that he knows who serves him. I've done this before, as Abigail of Thornham, but it's different when the point is the humiliation of serving as myself. Ixion's elbow brushes my hip in what seems like an inadvertent gesture, but the touch happens to brush the brand, and for a moment I see white.
Antigone, you remember Darius, I believe?
Among the Dragonborn sits the Forsworn Guardians, Lotus, who avoids looking at Rock, and Darius, the golden-haired golden boy of the Janiculum, and a friend of Powers from the years when he bullied me. During the first rider tournaments, I won my first public match against him. Darius sits frozen, stricken at the introduction, his marble skin flushing.
You don't want to say hello? Ixion asks.
Hi, Annie.
Darius croaks like he has glass in his throat. Hello, Darius.
Darius was telling me a fascinating little story over aperitifs, Ixion goes on, about a time when he and Parsival cornered you and Leo, and something curious happened.
Darius has begun to visibly perspire. I stand frozen, the pitcher clutched uselessly in two shaking hands.
He claims that you were able to summon your dragon with your mind without a summoning whistle. Is that true, Antigone?
I unstick my throat. Darius hunches in his chair. Ixion's glittering eyes are fixed on mine. Titus Greyheather comments from the seat that was mine.
Seems unlikely for a peasant.
I agree, Ixion says. However, that is how the story goes. I wonder, where is Parsival? I would like to hear whether he can corroborate this curious story. You haven't seen him. Have you, Dilo?
Dilo Skyfish, returned from his stint as a political hostage in Norcia, and summoned from the Skyfish Summer Palace to claim his throne in the Triple Coronation, has been absorbed in careful conversation with the only child at the table, Astyanax Hay Aurelian, the third ascendant heir. Dilo twists around, blinking.
Sorry, who?
Ixion's smile is icy.
Parsival, formerly known as Power, your hay cousin? Have you seen him? I would speak to him.
Dilo's face smooths.
I'm afraid not. Patrol, maybe?
He returns his attention to Astyanax, who breathlessly resumes whatever story he's been recounting. I'm turning away myself when Ixion's hand darts out. He twists a finger into my hair to pull my